Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
We've got a great show lined up for you.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
That was great. That's all I'm going to say. Okay, so here's what St. Teresa of Avila had to say. Beautiful little aphorism, something that you can tuck away in your memory or jot it down and then pray it whenever you feel, you know, the nerves tingling and you feel beaten down or you feel discouraged. So here it goes. She said, "Let nothing disturb you. Let nothing frighten you. All things are passing away. God never changes. Patience obtains all things. Whoever has God lacks nothing. God alone suffices," which is exactly correct. So maybe, you know what, Cyrus, maybe, you know what, don't do it. I'll do it. I'll post this on Twitter.
Yeah, I want to read that.
Yeah, you can retweet it.
So fast. Can you do that one more
time? Yeah, I'll read it again. Okay. And then I'm going to post it on Twitter momentarily. "Let nothing disturb you. Let nothing frighten you. All things are passing away. God never changes. Patience obtains all things. Whoever has God lacks nothing. God alone suffices." Super.
Amen to that.
Yeah. No wonder she's a doctor of the church. Let's go to Francis now in Phoenix. Good morning, Francis. Welcome.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. You were talking about Matt's rubrics, like around, I think that was Tuesday.
Yeah.
And it came to my mind, what's your take on, what's the rubrics on the Kyrie or the Lord have mercy? Because oftentimes it's the choir that leads it or sings it, or there's a cantor that says, "Lord, have mercy," and all that. Mm-hmm. Should it not be the priest that's invoking that for us, and then we respond? What's your take on that?
Well, let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. Whether or not there's a choir, the priest certainly can do that. But it's not required that the priest do it. And so it is, like, say, in my parish, it's very common that at the 10:30 Mass, the choir, they will sing the Kyrie. And so it's not required that the priest do it. He can do it, and he often does do it, but the rubrics don't require that the priest intone that. It can be the choir, can be the cantor.
Oh, okay. But is it not better, like, it's the priest leading it or invoking God, like, "Lord, have mercy," and then the congregation would say, "Lord, have mercy," and all that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, better, it's hard to say better. It doesn't have more power. It's not going to cause God to give you more or less mercy, depending upon who's intoning that. Maybe aesthetically or looking at the symbolism of the priest standing in the role of Jesus at the altar. Sure, mm-hmm. I can see there's a heightened sense of the mystery of the ministry of the priest and the action of Jesus. But I don't think it, in fact, I think I could say with certitude that it doesn't change the effect for the people who are there, whether or not the priest intones it or the choir intones it or the cantor intones it. It has the same net effect either way.
Could you say the same thing with the Gloria? Because usually the priest says, "Glory to God in the highest," and then
Yeah, I think the same would be true there as well. I mean, certain parts of the Mass are reserved for the priest himself, and no one else is supposed to do that. So, like the peripsum, you know, when the priest holds up the chalice and the consecrated host and he says, "Through him, with him, and in him," that's for the priest alone. Mm-hmm. It's not for the deacon. It's not for the people in the congregation. It's not for the choir. So there are certain rubrics that apply just to the priest. But the Kyrie and the Gloria are not among those. Those could be intoned by the choir.
Well, would it... would you say, is it wrong then for me? Or I hear some people say when the priest like threw him with him, and then they say it the same way, threw him with him and in him. So that's just for the priest.
Just for the priest. Yeah. The people should not be saying that out loud. Now, you can pray it in your heart. You can mm-hmm. think of it in your mind. I mean, it's not like you're sinning or anything, but it's not a mm-hmm. prayer that the people are supposed to be praying. It's the prayer that the priest prays at the altar. Same with the words of consecration, for example. You know, let's say that you knew them by heart, mm-hmm. and many Catholics do. Well, I mean, you can be praying along with the priest in your heart and your mind, but you wouldn't audibly, out loud, be saying the words of consecration. That's for the priest, not for you.
Mm-hmm. And can I make a quick comment on that sure. lady that called about Proposition 65 in California?
I don't remember that call. When was that?
A while ago, a few minutes ago, about his religious articles, reading something like chemicals and all that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember that call.
Yeah, there's a law in California that manufacturers should put that warning if a certain chemical that's considered by California to be carcinogenic, that they should put a label on it. Most of the time, it's those... made in China and all that and everything. So it's basically all over the place. It's just California that puts out that law that there should be a sticker there or a note that says that this is toxic or carcinogenic and all that.
Interesting. That is interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, I learned something new today, Francis. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Nice chatting with you, too. Interestingly, a note came in a little while ago from Brenda listening in Denver on that same topic. She says, in reference to contaminated products, the wood contaminant would be calcium chloride phosphate. It's basically a preservative for wood. It's not much in use anymore, so that kind of surprises me, she says. And in the metal, it could be concerned about lead products, which also confuses me, but it's all I can think of. Your happy chemistry listener. I wonder if you teach chemistry, Brenda. I vaguely remember from my days of taking chemistry in high school, I was not good at sciences, but I do remember hearing about things like cadmium, chloride, phosphate. By the way, and thanks for the email, I appreciate it. By the way, do you ever stop to think, everybody, about how things like these elements, these different, the way the molecules combine, H2O, for example, they combine always the same way every time, or they don't combine, or they won't combine always the same way every time. There's certain laws, certain rules, and they follow these laws, these elements. And so that's a great question to ask yourself. Where did these laws come from? You know,
I can't change the laws of physics.
If God doesn't exist, why isn't everything just chaos? If it's just the hurly-burly of the cosmos and all of these undirected natural forces working in a blind and undirected manner against each other endlessly over time. If that's all that's really going on here, then where did these laws come from? Why do chemicals react and behave the way they do? And they always do. That's how you get water, H2O. You can't have H3O or H23. Or some crazy combination. Why does it do that? That's a question to ponder. Now, I think the answer to that is because there is a mind higher than the cosmos. We call that mind God, who imposes order on chaos. Just a thought. Let's see. Let's go now to Francis in Coventry, Rhode Island. Good morning, Francis.
Good morning, Patrick. I was told to keep it brief, so I will.
Okay.
What I am interested in... Yeah, I'm not supposed to ask you how you are or anything, so we'll keep
okay.
it brief.
Fair enough.
I say a prayer nightly. Okay. I say a prayer nightly, and in the prayer, I'm sure you're familiar with it, it says, He, Jesus, descended into hell. The third day he arose again from the dead. I began to wonder, why did he spend 3 days in hell? Does it elaborate anywhere?
Yeah, it does. So it's a question that comes up with regularity. And it's one of those things that I think people, they trip over the word hell in the creed, where we say that he descended into hell. Of course, it has a connotation that Jesus went to the hell of the damned. He went to the place where the demons go. And that's not exactly what happened. When Jesus died on the cross, he went to what is known as the limbo of the fathers, variously, or paradise, it's also called. In fact, when Jesus was dying on the cross, he turned to the thief on his right and said, I tell you, this day you will be with me in paradise. So the way to understand this, the way to understand this is to realize that the Hebrew word for the underworld was Sheol, and the Greek word, as we would say it in English, is Hades. And those two words refer to the same place, the place where the dead would go. So good or bad, they would go to the underworld. And Jesus gives a description of this, Francis, in Luke 16, where he talks about Lazarus and the rich man. And I know you're familiar with this passage, so I won't read the whole thing to you. But we're told that Lazarus and the rich man both die. The rich man goes to a place of fiery torment and punishment. Lazarus goes to a place of peace and tranquility, and he's with Abraham. And the rich man, seeing this, cries out, Father Abraham, please send Lazarus with some water to cool my tongue. And Abraham says, no. He says, there's a great gulf or a great chasm fixed between where you are and where we are. And we cannot cross to where you are, and you cannot cross to where we are. Now, they were all in the underworld, Sheol, Hades. But there were two distinct areas, so to speak. So with that in mind, that's from Luke 16, by the way. With that in mind, when you come to the creed and it says he descended into hell, hell in this context is the archaic use of the word. It doesn't mean the hell of the damned. It doesn't mean where the devil is. It means the place where the good people were in the underworld, where Abraham and Moses and all the way back to Adam and Eve, all the good people who were destined for heaven but couldn't get into heaven because Jesus had not yet died on the cross, they were waiting. And that's what it means by hell. And that's where Jesus went. Now, a biblical example here, we see this in 1 Peter chapter 3. It says in verse 18, for Christ also suffered for sins once, the righteous for the sake of the unrighteous, that he might lead you to God. Put to death in the flesh, he was brought to life in the spirit. In it, he also went to preach to the spirits in prison, who had once been disobedient while God patiently waited in the days of Noah during the building of the ark. So in other words, Jesus went to those righteous of the Old Testament. And then it repeats it again in an oblique way in 1 Peter chapter 4 in verse 6. It says, for this is why the gospel was preached even to the dead, that though condemned in the flesh in human estimation, they might live in the spirit in the estimation of God. That's what Jesus did. He went there. It's sometimes known as the harrowing of hell. And it's where he went and preached the good news to those assembled people of the Old Testament era and then brought them to heaven. Does that help clarify it for you? It's a bit of a long answer.
Yes, it
does. That help?
No, but it was a great answer, and it cleared everything up, because, you know, I was just thinking about it the last 3 days, and I thought, well, I'm going to call Patrick Madrid. I listen to you all the time, but I listen to you at night. I rarely get a chance to listen to you in the morning. So I listen to you reprogramming at night. But
well,
I love the show, and I listen every night. And thank you very much. I won't take up any more of your time. I'm sure you have other callers. But
well,
I
I'm here for you, Francis. I'm here for you. So thank you for that call, and do call again. Let's go now to Lewis in Albuquerque. Hi, Lewis.
Oh, good morning. Good morning to all the people associated there at Relevant Radio.
Thank you.
I'm calling because there was you made a comment it may have been a month ago by now, mm-hmm. and it was about an article you said you wrote after a meeting called The Mormon. And the basic premise of the individual was that communion was not dealt was not approached seriously. And I think mm-hmm. I have the answer. You were saying you weren't sure why he saw that, and it's a simple word: routine. Everyone who goes to Mass gets up, goes to communion, and it's not like we receive communion once every 3 months. It's every week. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something that I was pondering after your show, and really just that.
Okay, I mean that's a fair observation. I don't disagree with that. For those who don't know what you're referring to, I was sharing with, and it was actually a chapter in a book I wrote called Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years, and that's a chapter in it. And to summarize it, what happened was I was speaking at a parish in San Diego, and after my talk, there was a Mormon gentleman in the audience, and he was waiting to talk to me in the back of the chapel, back of the church. And when I went back there to the book table, he said, "I noticed you did a little curtsy in front of the altar. What was that for?" And I said, "Oh, that's just a genuflection. It's a sign of respect to Jesus and the Blessed Sacrament because he's present in the Eucharist in the tabernacle." And so, Lewis, what happened was he said, "Oh, well, yeah, I guess I've heard that Catholics believe that Jesus is really there." He says, "I don't believe that." And I was starting to explain it to him a little bit, and he said, "Well, I don't know if other Catholics really believe what you believe. I mean, you say you believe Jesus is there, but," he says, "I've been to weddings and funerals and other masses before, and it sure looks to me like the Catholics who go up to communion, they don't believe that that's God because they don't seem to show much reverence or they don't seem to show respect." I forget the word that he used, but it was something along those lines. And he said, "If I believed that that was really Jesus, I would be flat on my face. I would be bowing down. I'd be, you know, prostrate before Jesus." And he said, "I don't think Catholics believe that's really Jesus because they don't seem to show the respect." And that really stuck with me because it was an indictment that is true of some Catholics anyway. And so in my chapter, I shared that as a way to remind Catholics that not only, I mean, do we believe that Jesus is truly present, but also that we can anti-evangelize people by our own, to go to the point you're making, Lewis, if it's just routine and you just do it because that's how you've always done it, and you don't really give it any thought when you receive communion, therefore you're not going to really show much by way of reverence because it doesn't really mean anything to you. And there are people who are observing this and making and drawing conclusions on this basis, and look at this Mormon guy who drew an erroneous conclusion, but I could understand why he did, because it didn't show in the behavior of the Catholics that he was observing. So I thought it was a great object lesson. So to your point, yes, if it is because it's become routine and it's humdrum and they don't give any thought to it, that makes perfect sense why they wouldn't show reverence.
Yeah, that did sort of make me think about what I do every Sunday. I would say a very informative discussion you had and presentation. I'm not sure how long ago it was, roughly a month ago, maybe.
That sounds about right. I do remember mentioning it. Well, thanks for bringing that up again, Lewis. And if you found that particular anecdote interesting, I have a feeling you'll like the rest of the book. It's called Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years. And that's one of those lessons. So you'll find other ones like that in that book. All right, Lewis, thank you. Appreciate it very much. Let's listen to a little Paul McCartney, and I will be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
I get it, Cyrus. I get it. You're quick on the draw. Okay, so I have an email that comes in from Brenda, and I read an email from her a little while ago, and so I was talking a little bit about my adventures in chemistry, and I asked the question, well, H2O, why do chemical compounds always bind the same way every time to produce the same things? So Brenda was kind enough to send me a note just now. She's listening in Denver, by the way. Shout out, Denver. Hey, Denver, thanks for listening. And so the subject line is H2O could also could sometimes be H3O. And I was just pulling elements out of the air. I had no idea. I was not good in science. So here's what she says. She says, here's the technical answer just for you. As I understand, you were A-plus in chemistry. Ha ha. H3O is not a commonly used chemical. H3O plus is the hydronium ion, which is, pay attention, Cyrus. There's going to be a test on Monday. H3O plus is the hydronium ion. See, I'm already asleep at this point, which is a water molecule with an extra proton H plus attached to it. This ion is formed when a proton is added to water. Think distilled water. Fair enough. This is why I was not good in science. My eyes start glazing over. By the time you're getting to hydronium ions, I'm half asleep already. But thank you, though. I appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Tony in Pasadena, thank you for calling and welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Hey. Yeah, Patrick, I have a question. I was listening to your observation or your encounter with the Mormon.
Yeah.
And the observation that the Mormon had about the tabernacle. So
yeah, it was really more about... Yeah, it was really more... His observation was more about, like, he'd never really noticed that Catholics seemed to have much reverence when they went to communion. That was the main gist of it.
Right. Yeah, my question is that apparently Gandhi had a similar observation decades before Vatican II. Just wondering if you ever heard about Gandhi's observation of the tabernacle.
You know, I do remember him saying something about, you know, I would be Christian if it weren't for all the Christians I see, or something along those lines. But I'm afraid I don't know the one about the tabernacle. What's that one?
Yeah, he made two observations. So apparently he was on a tour of a Catholic church with a priest. And when they passed the tabernacle, Gandhi was intrigued and asked the priest, you know, what is that? And the priest said, well, it's the tabernacle. And the priest explained, you know, that's where we worship the body of Christ. That's where we get it. And Gandhi chuckled, and the priest questioned him and said, so I said, I guess you don't believe that. And Gandhi's observation, every waking moment in front of this tabernacle. Now, it's not too surprising. I mean, Gandhi wasn't a believer.
You kind of dropped out, and I didn't hear, but it sounded like you, in the silence, it sounded like you said Gandhi said that if it really were Jesus, he would spend every waking moment in front of the tabernacle. Is that what you said?
Right.
Okay.
And that
well, that's exactly the kind of point that this Mormon fellow was making.
Right. And it kind of ties into what you mentioned about Gandhi. Apparently, Gandhi read the Bible every day, and when asked why didn't he convert, and he said, "Well, the Christians in the Bible aren't like the Christians I know." Referring, I suppose, to their lack of respect to the tabernacle.
I was pulling that up, so I have the quote as given here. This is in the Harvard Crimson website. And so here's how it was recorded in 1927. I like your Christ, but not your Christianity, according to Gandhi. I believe in the teachings of Christ, but you on the other side of the world do not. I read the Bible faithfully and see little in Christendom that those who profess faith pretend to see. The Christians, above all others, are seeking after wealth. Their aim is to be rich at the expense of their neighbors. They come among aliens to exploit them for their own good and cheat them to do so. Their prosperity is far more essential to them than life, liberty, and the happiness of others. The Christians are the most warlike people. So that's the verbatim quote as Gandhi gave it. And of course, in context, of course, he's dealing with, I think he's referring primarily to the English who had colonized so much of the world, and he was reacting to their rapacious effort to squeeze as much wealth out of India and other places as possible. So he was scandalized by the bad behavior of those British Christians, maybe among others. So I can see his point. But that's not in itself, as you know, it's not a reason to reject Christianity per se. He was just scandalized by the bad Christians that he was dealing with.
Right, yeah, that's his more famous observation. The other observation about the tabernacle was a tie-in that I just remembered when you were talking about the Mormon gentleman that you met.
Right, right. No, that's a good tie-in. And I was unaware of the tabernacle anecdote pertaining to Gandhi, but I'm glad I know it now.
Okay, well, thanks for taking my call, Patrick. Have a good day.
You got it. Thank you. And watch out for the little old lady from Pasadena. She's out there on the roads.
Right. Yeah, yeah, the Beach Boys.
That's right. Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it. Here's the number to call, 888-914-9149. We have lines open now. You can call now, 888-914-9149. Let's go over now to Phoenix and talk to Martin. Hi, Martin.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Patrick. Hey, just a little note on RCIA. This goes back 80 years. My aunt was not a Catholic, and it was in Fort Leonard, Missouri in 1943 or 1944. Well, they were going to marry these men. My uncle was a Catholic, and before they went off to the war, so they went in a room, and the priest the priest said, "How many of you are not Catholics?" So they raised their hand. "How many of you would like to be Catholics?" They raised their hand. And he said, "I pronounce you Catholics in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen." And they were Catholics. That simple. They didn't have to go to any more of these classes or anything like that. And just to, so then, my uncle John went off to the war in Europe. And my Aunt Betty told me that, you know, I never knew for weeks whether he was alive or not, you know, because that's how slow the mail was, whatever. But the nice part of the story is they were married over 50 or 60 years. They stayed Catholics all their life. They raised their children Catholics. And I know they're buried in a veteran cemetery in Denver called Fort Logan. They're not buried in a Catholic cemetery there, but they're still Catholics. But I just can't understand how, you know, if that was that simple to become a Catholic back then, and they sincerely, you know, became, she, you know, was, and I just maybe think nowadays people are either they're not as sincere, or they're not as intelligent, or they simply just don't even, they just don't believe what they're doing as much as maybe the people back at that time, you know, but it was just that simple.
Okay, let me take a look at that.
She told me this. I mean, I remember just going to their house, you know, and she told me this story, and I see no reason why, you know, it would, you know, yeah.
I get it. Okay, so I think there's maybe a little something lost in translation for this reason, that although it is true that especially in an emergency situation, somebody can become Catholic immediately, it would require certain things. So if some of the guys in that room who raised their hand, yeah, I want to be Catholic, if they weren't baptized, well, the only way for them to become Catholic in any formal sense would be to first to be baptized. So it wasn't as simple as the priest just waving his hand, making the sign of the cross and saying, okay, poof, now you're Catholic. It doesn't work that way, and it didn't work that way then either. So if the guy was not baptized, the first thing is he would be baptized. Now, maybe the priest did baptize them then and there, but they would have to have been baptized. And then, of course, to be fully united with the church or fully initiated in the church, the sacraments of the Holy Eucharist and confirmation are necessary. So if the man who was coming into the church was already baptized, well, then in order for him to become Catholic, he would have to make a profession of faith, he would have to go to confession, and then after that, he could receive Holy Communion, and he would be confirmed. Now, these are requirements to be Catholic that go all the way back to the early church. So it's not something like back during World War II, they had a streamlined version of this. They did not. It's possible, Martin, that the priest was, you know, kind of playing fast and loose and didn't do the things that the church required. But my suspicion is there's more to this story than was told to you, and that he probably did say, okay, you guys can become Catholic today, right now. And for those of you who aren't baptized, come over here and I'll baptize you. And then we'll, you know, you'll receive the other sacraments. But it's not as though there was a time when you could just have somebody tell you, okay, now you're Catholic, and then you were Catholic, because you can't be Catholic that way. You can't actually be a Catholic without receiving the sacrament of baptism and those other sacraments. You follow what I'm saying here?
Yeah, well, see, but, you know, it's a little bit mixed up, because the man was a Catholic, my uncle was a Catholic, and my aunt was not a Catholic. So these were women in a room that they were all wanted to be Catholics so they could marry the Catholic men before the Catholic men went to fight the war. And so I don't know if they were baptized in the Protestant church or the Seventh-day Adventist church or whatever they were before they went in there, you know. I don't know, you know. I mean, I didn't know that. I heard this when I was a little kid, you know what I mean? But but there you go.
Well, that's why I think, I'm not arguing with your story, don't get me wrong, but I think there are more details as to what actually happened that day in that room. So the thing I just want to leave you with is, don't think that the church is doing something aberrant or unnecessary by requiring preparation to become Catholic. That's important for the people to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it, so that they will be true followers of Jesus and they can be committed. You know, what does Jesus say? If a man puts his hand to the plow and then later on he looks back, he's not worthy of me. And I could easily see how somebody might say, yeah, I love Jesus, I want to be a Catholic, where do I sign? And then after a while, without sufficient preparation, he does what Jesus talks about. He's already put his hand to the plow, and now he's looking back thinking, well, do I really want to do this? That's not a good situation for him to be in.
Okay.
Well, thanks,
very
Martin.
Good.
Nice chatting with you. 888-914-9149 is the number to call to be on the air. 888-914-9149. Have a note here from Rosemary, listening on the Relevant Radio app, and she says, with regard to Dives and Lazarus, Dives is the Latin name for the rich man in Luke 16, and Dives just simply is the Latin word for rich or rich man. That's why he has that name. She says, Patrick, I was told at one time that this passage refers to purgatory. I didn't realize it was telling of just heaven and hell. Can you give some biblical references for purgatory? Thanks so much, and God bless your work. Thanks, Rosemary. Well, the question of purgatory can be associated with Luke 16 and Jesus' teaching about where Lazarus and the rich man went. But strictly speaking, his point there is the underworld per se, that the souls of everybody who died, and this, of course, is true to some extent, you might say, other than those who go straight to heaven. Those who are in purgatory are not in heaven, but they're not in hell, so they're in this third place that Jesus describes. So was the rich man in hell? It seems like he was, and I think the majority opinion is that he was in hell because he's in this place of fiery torment. However, I think there's a tantalizing detail that might open the door, even just a crack, to the possibility that he wasn't in hell or that he wasn't going to be damned in the long run. And that is because he evinces a kind of charity for his brothers who are still alive. You'll notice that he's interceding for them. He's interceding with Abraham on the behalf of his brothers who are still alive, that they should not come to that place of punishment. That's charity. So if indeed that's what was going on, it raises the question, well, then maybe he was in purgatory, and maybe he wasn't in hell because he's showing charity. Now, we know that the souls in hell do not have any charity. They don't love God. They don't love you. They don't love themselves. They don't love anybody. And so they can't have that supernatural gift. They can't have that virtue in a soul that's completely dead, spiritually speaking. And it seems like he did. So that's a possibility. Maybe he was in purgatory. Now, another passage that I would recommend would be 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and you can start reading in verse 10, where without using the term purgatory, St. Paul describes it. And he describes after death the man's life being judged and how this judgment reveals the works of his life through fire. And the fire burns away those things that are not compatible with God's holiness. And he describes them there as flammable material, like wood, hay, and straw. And he says this burning away, this purging of these flammable things involves suffering. and he suffers while this is taking place. He says he will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. So he's not in heaven yet. He's dead. His life is being revealed. The bad works are being purified and burned away. He's not in heaven yet, but he will go to heaven once this has happened as he passes through this fiery purification. So that's another passage that will be helpful to you. Let's take a break and we'll come back to the phones. Here's the number, 888-914-9149. Call now, 888-914-9149.
Relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Welcome back. And the number is 888-914-9149. Have you signed up for Father Rocky's Lenten Lessons yet? They're free, and they're little videos that will come to you one each day during Lent. So 40 of them. And they will explain to you, as Father Rocky does in his inimitable way, the aspects of the Mass that maybe you're not familiar with. Or you may think you're familiar and say, oh, wow, I never knew that. So these are free. They're instructive. They're little video clips. And really, all you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/lessons and tell us what email address to send it to, and you'll start receiving them beginning with Ash Wednesday, which is next week. So check it out. The number to call again, 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Jeff in Southern California. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how are you? I have a situation. I am a spiritual director, and I have a gentleman that I am working with. And he has, his wife has been married previously in the Catholic Church, has received a civil divorce. When they married, they did not get married in the Catholic Church, but they would like to get married in the Catholic Church. They have not been receiving communion for a while, and they approached their parish priest about getting annulments and all that, and he asked about it. There was some difficulty in getting the documents they needed to start the process. Well, in the process, the parish priest blessed them, and in that conversation somehow they believe now that they have this ability to go back to Mass and receive communion. And that's been going on for about 4 years. They've been married about 15 years, and I don't know how to approach it.
Well, if I understand correctly, there has not yet been issued a declaration of nullity for those two earlier marriages, is that right?
Yeah, just the wife's earlier marriage. The husband was not married earlier, but you are correct.
Okay, so that being the case, if that's really what's necessary in order for them to be able, in good faith, to be married to each other now. So without that declaration of nullity, the presumption is that that first marriage was valid. And if it was valid, as it's presumed to be, then they're living in adultery. And if they're living in adultery, that's objectively mortally sinful. They should not be receiving Holy Communion. So if they were confused or misled because the priest gave them a blessing and they thought, oh, well, I guess now we can go to communion, if these other issues are not taken care of, then they're just mistaken. Somebody needs to clarify that for them.
So what you're saying then is it's my job to talk to them about it and at least, or talk to him about it and present them with the facts just as you have and let them decide what they're going to do from that point on.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So, you know, in the catechism, in the section on the Holy Eucharist, there is a lengthy section about how to be prepared to receive the Eucharist. And so if somebody realizes that he's in the state of mortal sin, he should not receive the Holy Eucharist until he's gone to confession. So that's, you know, that's spelled out, and, you know, I'm trying to remember.
Pretty straightforward.
it's pretty straightforward. Let me give you an example here. So this is in paragraph 1395. So it says, and I, let me see if this is the right one here. Okay. By the same charity that it enkindles in us, the Eucharist preserves us from future mortal sins. The more we share the life of Christ and progress in his friendship, the more difficult it is to break away from him by mortal sin. The Eucharist is not ordered to the forgiveness of mortal sin. That is proper to the sacrament of reconciliation. The Eucharist is properly the sacrament of those who are in full communion with the church. So they are, in an objective sense, not in full communion with the church because they're living together as man and wife when they don't have a right to do that because they don't know whether or not her first marriage was invalid. And the presumption, as I said, is that it is valid until it's shown not to be valid.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct. But can I ask you one other thing then?
Sure,
I'm also, I have a relationship with the priest that actually gave them the blessing. Would you recommend that I speak to him first or just talk to the couple or the gentleman, I should say? What do you think would be the best approach?
That seems wise to me. I mean, do you know the couple well enough that you could bring this up to them, or do you think it would seem like you're meddling?
Oh, they're new. So I would say, you know, I'm familiar with them at the parish, but, you know, mm-hmm. this is only the first or second time I've met with them. So I would say I've got a much better relationship with the parish priest than I do with the couple.
I see. Well, in that case, then I would go to the priest, you know, and say, from where I stand, it kind of looks like this is a misunderstanding on their part. And therefore, if you think if you agree with me, Father, then my recommendation would be to just mention it to them so that if there is a misunderstanding, it could be cleared up.
Right. Okay. All right.
And if I can give you the paragraph, because I wanted to give you the specific paragraph where the catechism says this, it's 1415. Anyone who desires to receive Christ in Eucharistic communion must be in the state of grace. Anyone aware of having sinned mortally must not receive communion without having received absolution in the sacrament of penance. So that's the money quote. And
okay.
You know, it's not bad news, it's good news. And the good news is,
right.
Hey, get right with God and then you can receive communion.
Right, right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And I love your show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, they make a mistake like that in good faith because they just don't know. And they were never really told. So one of the precepts of the church is to admonish the sinner. Another one is to give good counsel. And that's what this gentleman that you just heard on the show is doing. He's seeking to give good counsel, but he wants to go about it in a tactful way. That's good. So let's go now to Nikki in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Nikki.
Good morning, Patrick. So bizarre that was the topic this man was talking about, because my question is, married, been divorced for 15 years from my children's dad, got an annulment, I'm remarried. So our marriage was nullified. He recently, about a couple years ago, started dating very nice, kind, wonderful woman.
Who are you talking about? Your first husband?
My first husband, yes, sorry. My first husband's friend that he's dating now. Super wonderful. I get along with her. The kids get along with her. Well, come to find out, she explained one weekend ago that she had this big, beautiful Catholic wedding years ago to her first husband. And my daughter, who's 20, is like, oh, so, you know, you got it annulled and all. And she's like, oh, no, I don't believe in any of that. She's not a practicing Catholic anymore. Mm-hmm. So now my kids and I are sort of like faced with the fact that their dad is dating a married woman in the eyes of God.
Mm-hmm.
And how we explain this to the dad, their dad, that now it's, they feel like they can't go on like camping trips with them or go to, not that the two of them ever do that whole sleeping together or anything around the kids. Like, you know, knows, like their dad knows that that's not right, but they still go and do things with her and him. And they're like, but now like we see this as he's dating a married woman. How do we explain to him that we can't go and do things with them and all anymore? How would you explain this?
How old are the kids, first of all?
24, 22, 20, 18, and 16, and they're very much in their faith, and they know.
That's
so
good.
Yeah, so they don't want to hurt their dad's feelings, and they really like this woman. I really like this woman. I've actually been working with her, trying to get her back to the Catholic Church, and I feel like, oh, if we explain this now, it's just going to blow up in our faces. But at the same time, they know they cannot omit the fact that she's a married woman in the eyes of God. How would they explain that to their dad?
I mean, I think just quote Jesus. I mean, Jesus says, Matthew chapter 5, Matthew chapter 19, and in other passages, Jesus says, if a man divorces his wife and marries another, a woman, he commits adultery. It's very clear. And of course, your husband, having gone through the process of an annulment, he knows that the church cannot nullify a valid marriage. If it's valid, it's valid. And the church can't change that. But the church can determine whether or not it was valid, or was it null from the beginning. And if so, then it can declare nullity in that case. So he's aware, he's familiar with that. So, you know, he already knows that that's necessary for him to consider marrying this woman, and if she does not have
one little bit of information is, so he was never Catholic. He went through it for me, knowing that I needed it, and yeah. So he again also he claims to be a Christian and all, and it's wonderful, but he doesn't. You know, it's sort of pick and choosing, just like she has now said, you know, she doesn't practice Catholic faith because she's got too many problems with it. And but like I tell my kids, and like we talked with our priest, like it doesn't take away from the fact that in God's eyes, she is a married woman still.
That's true.
So,
well,
yeah.
I don't really know much, how much you can do in this scenario. So if he's no longer your husband, he's not, he's not a Catholic. He knows, nonetheless, the church is teaching on this issue, and she's a Catholic. She presumably knows this. I would put it this way. If you see an opportunity where you could, in a tactful and kind way, explain this to her, maybe even give her a book. There's a good book by Ed Peters. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Answers to Difficult Questions. And that would be a great way to say, here, if you're interested in knowing what the Catholic Church teaches, here's a book that explains it. And then maybe you've done your part and you can just leave it be. I really don't get the impression that there's a project here that you have to work on. You know, you can tell them the truth and then leave it.
Because they don't want to hurt their dad. Like that now they can no longer go and do things with him and her.
Yeah, that would be one outcome, that they could say, well, we don't accept that they're validly married, therefore we can't do this. I don't think it has to be that rigorous, honestly. I don't think they have to say, I'm sorry, we can't be in your company because your marriage is not valid in the eyes of the church. I don't think it has to take that form, honestly.
Well, not rudely, no. I agree. But, I mean, they say, you know, we can't go and happily go along and do things when she's a married woman and she's dating our dad.
This is an area of conscience. And so it sounds to me like your children have well-formed consciences. That's good. I applaud you because it's probably from you that they got that. And so if in their conscience they feel that if they were to visit and you know, have whatever activities with them, that it would be somehow tacitly approving or giving the impression that they approve of their living arrangement, then, you know, good for them if they feel this is what they need to do. On the other hand, if they felt like, well, we're going to continue to have this relationship, so it's going to take the form of getting a meal at a restaurant or, you know, other things that will involve them being together, and it's a great way for us to maybe evangelize them, him and her. That's a good thing too. You know, it sounds like a work in progress. And if they want to be part of the solution, they're in a good position to do that. Seems
to me. Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
I hope it works out.
You're welcome, Nikki. Nice chatting with you. Let's see if we can get to, let's see if we can get to Jennifer in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Hi, Jennifer.
Patrick, I have a quick question about an article you recommended or about CRT in the school, in the Catholic school, why it doesn't work with our Catholic faith.
Oh, you're talking about critical race theory?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Well, there was, I'm trying to remember his first name. I think it was Christopher Ruffo, R-U-F-F-O.
Yeah.
Okay. So he wrote a kind of a, it's a book, but it appeared in the form of a PDF online. And it was published, I believe, by Imprimis, which is the publication from Hillsdale College. And so if you are looking for that, I would go there and then just search for his name and you'll find it. And so it has lots and lots of quotes about critical race theory from the main people who are promoting it. And actually, I just found it. So if you go to Imprimis and just type in critical race theory, boom, there it is. It's right there. Now, in addition to that, another book has come out subsequent to him doing that work. And this is a book by Dr. Edward Feser, F-E-S-E-R. This is a very good book. I have it. I've read it. It's quite good. It's called All One in Christ, A Catholic Critique of Racism and Critical Race Theory. So it's very thorough and logical. And I think if you read that book by Ed Feser, you'll find a lot more there. I mean, the stuff that Christopher Ruffo did is good. I'm just saying this will add more to your storehouse of knowledge.
Okay. I'm writing it down.
Okay. It's called, once again,
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So one more time with the title for those who didn't get it. It's called All One in Christ, A Catholic Critique of Racism. And it's by Dr. Edward Feser. And it's a good book, so I can assure you that if you get it, you're going to be more knowledgeable on that topic than you would be otherwise. Well, until tomorrow, I'm looking forward to it, by the way, 21 hours from now, I'm going to be right back here on the microphone, God willing. And I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.